Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, the Orange County Public School System is in the process of selling property in Eatonville to developers. Historic preservationists agree that the planned development will destroy the historic town.
Shortly after the town's incorporation, the Robert Hungerford Industrial and Normal School was established on the Booker T. Washington model at Tuskegee, Alabama.
We'll discuss crime and punishment in antebellum Pensacola.
Samuel Keep, in 1827, wrote to a relative that he was, quote, obliged not to step out of doors without both my pistols loaded, end quote.
And we'll talk with the authors of the new book, Florida, A History in Pictures. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
Now you can tear a building down, but you can't erase a memory.
Eatonville was established in 1887 as one of the first incorporated African-American municipalities in the United States. It's celebrated as the home of writer, folklorist, and anthropologist Zora Neale Hurston, and tens of thousands of people from around the world gather annually in Eatonville for a festival in her honor. As N.Y. Nathiri, executive director of the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community, explains, the Hungerford School is an important part of Eatonville history.
Shortly after the town's incorporation, the Robert Hungerford Industrial and Normal School was established on the Booker T. Washington model at Tuskegee, Alabama. In fact, the first principals of the Hungerford School came from Tuskegee, and it was a model school that looked at the connection between faculty and students living together. It was a boarding school. The school furnished all of its needs internally, that is, had chickens and hogs and grew crops. It was essentially a 19th century STEM school because the students were trained in the manual arts, industrial arts, trained if they wanted to go further after graduating. And so within the emotional fabric of the town of Eatonville, the school really represented that kind of close tie in the American society when the teacher, the preacher, and the doctor were fundamental to the core of society. That really is the Hungerford School, known for its academic excellence. And only in the desegregation era, when there was a systematic denigrating of high schools and academic schools in African-American communities, Hungerford fell on hard times, essentially after it became part of the public school system in the 1950s and 60s.
In 1951, the Orange County School District destroyed the original Hungerford School buildings and constructed new facilities. In 1974, a substantial portion of the Hungerford School property was sold to make way for the construction of I-4. In 2020, the Orange County School Board demolished the Hungerford School and wants to sell the site for more than $14.5 million. Developers are proposing to build hundreds of townhomes, as well as commercial and office space, in the heart of the historically black town. N.Y. Nathiri.
The people of Eatonville gave the land over to Orange County Public Schools specifically for the education, quote unquote, of Negro children. The reason I bring this forward is because Eatonville and the Hungerford property represents an exception to how Orange County Public Schools has property for educational purposes. The short answer to what would happen to Eatonville, it would actually be, historic Eatonville would be erased. And in fact, the inheritance, the legacy of that land, there would be no economic justice for the people of Eatonville and our posterity, because Orange County Public Schools would have sold the land to developers who, and I say this with confidence because so many of our preservationist friends who have reviewed these documents and the plans, there is 100% agreement that this is absolutely horrible development planning, and that the historic character of Eatonville would disappear and the town would disappear because of the configuration. You cannot take 100 acres of land and develop it in the way that's being proposed and keep the integrity of the historic character, the history, and the culture.
NY Nethiri and the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community have a very different vision for the Hungerford School property that includes a cultural campus to benefit residents while protecting the town's history.
Our commitment is to have the land be returned and put in a land trust such time that proper master planning could be conducted, and we could then as a community establish the highest and best use of the land, bringing to the issue the best minds, the best experiences nationally, because Eatonville is nationally significant. And I say that because we're talking to Florida Frontiers audience. This is an audience that has an appreciation for history and for heritage and for the continuity of history. So this is really about a current event that has implications for posterity.
The Southern Poverty Law Center for Economic Justice Project is helping with the effort to encourage planning carefully for the future use of the historic Hungerford School property.
This is an essential example of what it means when your network of relationships across disciplines comes to the fore. As I said, we have sent out these plans for review, and the resulting analysis was unanimous. And one of our friends in West Texas, who previously had been on faculty at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, suggested that research that graduate law students might find this a project that would be really of interest. That's how we started, because people might be interested in terms of the way the legal system works. You'd have to have what's called, I would call it, a supervising attorney local in the state of Florida. And so the University of Florida has a unit, and that might not be the right word, with the Southern Poverty Law Center and Kirsten Anderson, who heads the regional operation, has picked this up. And really, we are so grateful that the Southern Poverty Law Center sees this as a project worthy of exploration.
The developers' controversial plans for the historic Hungerford School property are under review by the state of Florida. We spoke with NY Nethiri, executive director of the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Registration is now open for the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum and the Florida State Genealogical Society Conference, being held May 18th through 20th in Lakeland. Just go to myfloridahistory.org for more information and to register. Amy Anderson from the La Florida Interactive Digital Archive of the Americas will be the keynote speaker. Other engaging presenters include Bob Keeling, author of the new book Good Day Sunshine State, How the Beatles Rocked Florida, Gary Mormino, author of the new book Dreams in the New Century, Instant Cities, Shattered Hopes, and Florida's Turning Point, Alonzo Felder, author of the book Discovering A.S.J. Allen, A Story of Skinfolk, Kinfolk, and Village Folk, and many others. There will be tours of the Frank Lloyd Wright architecture at Florida Southern College, visits to several local museums and archives, special musical performances, and much more. That's the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum and the Florida State Genealogical Society Conference, May 18th through 20th in Lakeland. Registration is now open at myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, if Tristan da Luna's 1559 settlement had lasted, Pensacola and not St. Augustine would have been the oldest continuously occupied European settlement in what would become the United States, but the town is a rich part of our state's history.
Although Pensacola is one of the oldest sites of European attempts at settlement in North America, the town was, in many ways, still a part of the borderlands in the state's territorial and early statehood era. And life on the borderlands was often short and brutal, as the philosopher said, and for the very reasons that inspired the remark. Frontier life had few restraints, with few structural manifestations of the power of the law. James M. Mike Denham, a professor at Florida Southern College in Lakeland, has spent his career studying crime and the court systems of antebellum Florida. In a 2011 article in the Florida Historical Quarterly, he focuses attention on crime and punishment in Pensacola and Escambia County in the period 1822 to 1860. Denham provides a summary of the views of contemporary Pensacolians on the causes of crime and violence and contrasts them with the interpretations on crime and punishment offered by historians and social scientists who study the American South. According to Denham, quote, most Pensacolians believe that drinking, gambling, moral depravity, and a Southern penchant for hot blood, both separate and together, were causes for violence and crime. A survey of scholars points to ethnic conflict, economic and racial conflict, a free-for-all political process, and America's root hog or die system of individualism as prominent factors. More specifically, Bertram Wyatt Brown argued for the role of the Southern system of values characterized as honor as a contribution to the region's penchant for violence. And writing on Florida in the antebellum period, Edward Batiste argued that, quote, the desire for mastery and antipathy toward submission dominated the individual consciousness and collective unconsciousness of white men who moved to Florida, end quote. Denham argues that the similarities of Pensacola to other Gulf Coast towns of the era, New Orleans, Mobile, and Tampa, and the rich archival sources on court activity without gaps for the entire antebellum period makes the city a model for the Gulf region. Pensacola included a heterogeneous population of Anglo-Americans, blacks, enslaved and free, and Spanish Creoles, with a cultural confluence of Spaniards, blacks, Scots traders, and indigenous people, primarily Creeks. In 1850, it had the largest free black population in the state, 375. As Florida's most important port on the Gulf, it had access to other cities such as New Orleans and Apalachicola, as well as the Caribbean and South America. A busy port with strong military presence, Pensacola was a frontier town with world connections. It was unusual from a historian's perspective in its preservation of criminal and court records. As Denham notes, when utilized with newspapers, state prosecution activity, and other sources, the court records shed light on many aspects of criminal activity in Pensacola, including the types of crimes that were committed, the frequencies to which they were committed, and the success or lack of success to which they were prosecuted. Patterns of punishment can also be discerned.
Connie, what were considered to be serious crimes in 19th century Pensacola, and how were these crimes dealt with?
Criminal activity fell into several discernible categories: murder, theft, fighting, runaway slaves, escaped criminals, gambling, and adultery. Denham notes that the most dangerous crimes were crimes against persons, and between 1822 and 1866, court minutes show 309 persons were indicted for violent crime, 36 for murder, 231 for assault and battery, and 39 for assault with intent to kill. Of that number, only 126 were convicted. Fighting between soldiers and sailors and the general population accounted for much of the violence. Samuel Keep, a Bostonian who supervised construction of the Navy Yard in 1827, wrote to a relative that he was, quote, obliged not to step out of doors without both my pistols loaded, end quote. Although violent, most assaults were not fatal and occurred at all levels of society, from laborers to political elites, and included free blacks and slaves. Theft was generally met with corporal punishment. Enoch Howe, who stole a pocketbook containing $115, a writing desk, and numerous articles of clothing, was sentenced to a fine of $50, forced to stand in the pillory for 2 hours, and receive 10 more stripes than the law allowed, a total of 49 lashes. Despite the physical severity of punishment, Pensacola continued to be plagued by crimes against property. In 1853, a theft ring headed by Samuel Piper stole $1,000 worth of silver from a British ship, blew up an iron chest in Davis and Cox's store, and made away with $1,600 in gold and $100 in gold from a second store.
Connie, today, opponents of gambling and drinking say that these vices can lead to more serious criminal activity, and as you pointed out, that was true in 19th century Pensacola as well.
Yes, gambling and drinking were viewed as both crimes and the source of other criminal activities. Pensacolians were especially concerned about, quote, Negro gambling houses and tippling shops, which resulted in manifold disorders to the interruption of the peace of the city, end quote. Enforcement of laws against retailing goods or spirits without a license, receiving stolen goods, keeping a disorderly house, and trading with slaves was intended to curtail underground activity and maintain the racial hierarchy. In 1838, Joseph Alton was fined $150 for trading boots and other stolen property with a slave named David and a white man. During that same term of court, he was indicted for, quote, keeping a disorderly tippling house where he procured certain persons, black and white, men and women, of evil name and fame, and disorderly conversation to frequent and come together, end quote. Alton lived a violent life, and in July 1839, he was stabbed to death outside his establishment. Legislators were also concerned with maintaining public order and morality and enacted numerous laws regulating personal behavior, particularly targeting adultery and illicit sex. Couples brought up on charges of cohabitation could, quote, prevent or suspend prosecution by marriage legally solemnized, end quote. Denham reports 50 indictments for adultery in the antebellum period, with 5 found guilty, 13 not guilty, and 32 cases that never reached a verdict. Gambling was the most frequently prosecuted public disorder and morality crime, although despite repeated legislative acts to outlaw gambling, residents actually had little to fear in regard to arrest and prosecution. Denham reports that Pensacolians played poker, bet on lotteries, and wagered on faro, a gambling game that swept through the Old Southwest in the 1830s and 1840s. Different segments of the population blamed one another for the prevalence of gambling. Protestants claimed that the predominance of the Roman Catholic Church accounted for, quote, the large number of gambling shops, end quote. But it was clear that they were not the only ones. Denham cites a commenter who noted that, quote, Anglo-American gamblers are as dexterous as in evading laws as they are in handling cards, end quote. Stamping out gambling proved impossible, no matter the level of public outcry. Punishment often proved elusive as well. Pensacola and Escambia County simply did not have the resources to effectively arrest, indict, prosecute, and punish criminal offenses. Denham points out that, quote, inefficiency and chronic underfunding was the norm in the South and a glaring characteristic of Escambia County government, particularly in Florida's territorial period. Sheriffs, U.S. Marshals, and their deputies worked on fees, and citizens were loath to pay taxes to incarcerate criminals. Richard Hassel Hunt, editor of the Pensacola Gazette, wrote in 1828 that, quote, our criminal jurisprudence is little less than a dead letter. There is no disposition to bring offenders to justice because there is not means of punishing them, end quote. Pensacola did not have a secure jail. Prisoners were housed in a basement room of the courthouse, and escapes were frequent. Moreover, the county provided no funding to feed prisoners. When a particularly violent criminal was arrested in 1827, he was housed in the jail for 11 days without food. Appeals to the Pensacola Board of County Aldermen to provide for the prisoner were rejected, and he was freed. Denham concludes his survey of crime and punishment by noting that it mirrors the history of other Southern states. Law enforcement was haphazard, underfunded, inefficient, and reflective of an honor-bound, frontier-like society. It was not a positive legacy for the future.
Interesting. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. A popular Facebook page has led to the creation of a new book. Holly Baker has this look at Florida, A History in Pictures.
Jeff Davies and Mike McGinnis published a book with 130 photographs of Florida covering the history of the Sunshine State. They talked with me about their book called Florida, A History in Pictures, that grew out of their Facebook group. Mike McGinnis.
The Facebook group is called Florida History in Pictures, same name as the book. We decided to change the name to have some continuity. The group was originally called Historic Florida. Once the book came out, we decided to make it the same name so people would be able to find us that knew of us by the book name and vice versa. So the book is an extension of the group, and the group is basically open to anyone who wants to join the group that is interested in Florida history and has something that they would like to add to the group, whether it be sharing a memory of the past or sharing a photo from their grandmother's photo album. We'd love to get interaction from our members who have a shared love of history like we do. We're always anxious to get new photos that people haven't seen before. It brings us a lot of joy to be able to share those with others that are also interested in Florida history.
Mike McGinnis was born in Orlando, and Jeff Davies relocated to Miami from New York at the age of 5. Both grew up with a love for Florida history. Their Facebook group, Celebrating Florida History Through Photographs, has gained more than 200,000 members to date. Their digital archive contains nearly as many photographs as members. Their group's popularity inspired Jeff Davies and Mike McGinnis to publish their book, Florida, A History in Pictures, in 2022. The book not only includes photographs of Florida, but also contains a timeline of events and historical information about each photograph. Jeff Davies.
Well, the book came about as an extension of the group. Around a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago, all the administrators received an email from a Canadian publisher, McIntyre Purcell Incorporated. We contacted the publisher. We had an initial meeting with them. We told them what our vision for the book was. They told us what they wanted the book to be. We were able to meet somewhere in the middle. And my feeling is the book is an extension of our group. The book is designed to act as a thank you to our existing members and also as an introduction to the folks who have never heard of us before.
I asked them to tell me about their favorite images of Florida from their book. Mike McGinnis.
My favorite photos would have to be family photos that I've put in there, ones of my grandmother, my father when he was young. I also enjoyed the early beach scenes, whether it be Palm Beach or Daytona Beach. I always find it interesting, the clothing that people chose to wear. inevitably we'll get comments from our members like, how did people stand the heat in Florida back then? But what most of them don't understand is that those were guests that were staying here during the winter. You know, they came down from Chicago, Boston, and places like that. So it was a little chilly on the beach back then. So also, some of the old sports photos that we have, Jeff was fortunate enough to go on the sidelines a few times for the Miami Dolphins, and we've got some old 1970s Miami Dolphins photos on there that no one has ever seen before. So we do strive to find pictures that others haven't seen before, so we'd like to be able to share those with others.
Jeff Davies also told me about his favorite photographs of Florida from the book.
Speaking for myself, some of the images that are my favorite are the ones some harken back to my childhood and others harken back to my love of history. For example, there's a photograph of the Miami Seaquarium where you have dolphins jumping on either side. That photograph was taken in 1976 by my best friend with a camera he received for his bar mitzvah on a school field trip. He is now a professional photographer, so that was something we wanted to include. In addition, a few of the photographs that were donated by our members of a group of men on horse, fox hunting, that intrigues me. It intrigues me because of the period piece. It intrigues me because we have it, nobody else does.
The book Florida, A History in Pictures would not have been possible without the contributions of Facebook group members and a dedicated team of administrators, people from all walks of life who were brought together by their love for Florida history. Jeff Davies.
We hope that folks discover the book, discover the group, and share our love and appreciation of our state, where we've been, and what's coming up in the future, and never forget what it took to get us there.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker, Public History Coordinator for the Florida Historical Society and Archivist at the Library of Florida History in Cocoa.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Registration is now open for the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum and the Florida State Genealogical Society Conference being held May 18th through 20th in Lakeland. Just go to myfloridahistory.org for more information and to register. There's also a link for discounted hotel registration at Spring Hill Suites by Marriott for conference attendees. Each morning of the conference, there will be engaging panel discussions and presentations on a variety of topics. Each afternoon, we'll take exciting tours, including a visit to Florida Southern College to see the Frank Lloyd Wright architecture there, a tour of the Lakeland History and Culture Center, the Polk Museum of Art, and the Polk County History Center and Genealogical Library. That and much more is part of the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum and the Florida State Genealogical Society Conference, May 18th through 20th in Lakeland. Registration information is at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Holly Baker. The program is edited by John White. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.